Everybody, and welcome to Patriotic Weekly Review, episode number 296. We're closing in on episode 300. That'll be February the 12th. Don't miss out on that. It will be 4 hours with as many guests as I can cram in. And we've got a great guest for you tonight who I'll be introducing shortly, and hopefully he will come back for 10 minutes on the 12th to be part of my epic mega anniversary special. Anyway, let's get on with the show, because I've got a few things to say before I introduce the golden one. The first is that we are live on Odyssey, DLive, Entropy, Rumble, all of the places you usually find me. Please share it. Please like the stream. Please boost this tonight, because we're talking about something really, really serious that affects both the golden one and really everyone in nationalism. Now, the second thing I'm going to say is my Friday video, before I introduce the golden one, you may have already heard, but the Golden One's been attacked, but so have we here in the UK. Over the last year, an undercover reporter has infiltrated Patriotic Alternative. Now, he actually came to us as this sort of down and out who needed help. And we actually got him a job on a building site. So he actually worked for one of our guys on a building site to sort of earn our trust. You know, he showed us his passport, he paid for a membership. He actually worked for one of our guys. And this tells you how what lousy people they are. Now, obviously, they've got all this evidence that we're terrible people. So they invited me to the BBC in Manchester on Sunday. I went there on Sunday. I debated with their journalist. I spoke to him for an hour and 9 minutes, which is obviously quite a long time to be talking to them. And I secretly recorded it all. They secretly record us, but I secretly recorded the entire exchange. And I'm going to make that public on Friday when I do my regular weekly video, a good 3 days before they do their stupid show, which means you can listen to the truth of the matter before they publish their hit piece. So look out on Friday for a undercover expose by me, Mark Collett, on the slimy BBC, and a full 1 hour and 9 minutes of me debating with a BBC journalist and putting him in his place. And then you can watch the show later next week, and you can see how they misrepresent me, because you'll have all the evidence to see how that goes on. Anyway, if you like this show, if you like the work I do, if you like the fact that I'm ballsy enough to go into the BBC and secretly record them and play them at their own game, please consider making a donation. You can contribute to the stream live tonight during the stream by hitting the support button either on Entropy or Odyssey, and that will allow you to send a super chat, a donation, a gift to me, and anything attached to that gift in terms of a message I'll read out live on air in the next hour of the show. Anyway, so please do consider contributing. Remember, all of your gifts go to a very good cause and ensure that we can keep doing the work we do. Now, you can also donate via cryptocurrency. All the crypto links are in the description below. And if you want to write to me, you can at mark@thefallofwesternman.com, and I answer all emails as quickly as humanly possible. So that's the intro. And I'll also be doing other things later in the week. But I want to get straight into what the Golden One's got to say. And obviously, it is the Golden One tonight. He's a fantastic role model for all young men. He's a guy who takes his personal image and his fitness very, very seriously. But he's also a man who's extremely intelligent, thoughtful, and produces some of the best content in the whole world in our ethno-nationalist sphere. He's somebody that's been an inspiration to me and millions of young men. Not that I'm a young man anymore. In fact, he's younger than me. Anyway, I'm going to start rambling in a minute, and I don't want to do that. So, Golden One, how are you doing, my friend? And did you have a lovely Christmas and New Year with your family?
All right. Thank you very much for those kind words. We did. I actually thought to say a few words about you as well. I thought to myself, because I know you're banned still on Twitter, but you've probably seen the whole grooming rape gang scandal. It's blown up. And, you know, I thought next time I do a stream with Mark, I'm just going to praise him for it, because now, of course, everyone knows about it. Everyone is talking about it. But you talked about this for 10 years ago, 15 years ago. I don't know for how long. So
20 years ago, I was arrested by the police after the BBC did a hit piece on me for talking about it.
Yeah. So 20 years ago, and now the whole world is talking about it. And these truly vicious people. They're facing intense scrutiny. So, you know, some motivational stuff for sure. And you say that I've been an inspiration, and likewise, you've been an inspiration for all of us. Been at it for a very long time. Felt a lot of pressure, and I will white pill, as is my custom. I will say good stuff, because we're going to talk about hit pieces, of course. Something to keep in mind always that I try to say is that for every time they cry wolf, or in our case, they cry fascist or right-wing extremist or whatever they might call the label, it loses its edge. The sword, it loses its edge. And of course, you felt the sword more keenly because it was sharper in the beginning. But now, you know, more and more people, they say that these journalists, they're lying, and we've been telling the truth the entire time. And now the conservatives, they're catching up on it. So what we're saying, it will have an effect. The message, it will reach out. It just maybe, even though we're, you know, we don't have the same reach as Elon Musk, the word will still reach in time. So I just wanted to say thank you to you who brought this, who bravely stood up before anyone else and spoke about it to great personal cost and risk and sacrifice. So shout out to Mark Collette for this.
Well, thank you very much. That was very, very kind of you. And I'm pleased that some people still remember the role I played, because, you know, certain things can be lost to history, and it's important that we remind the Tommy Robinson types that it wasn't actually Tommy Robinson who first came out with this. It was the ethno-nationalists. It's the people that even the Tommy lot call racist were the ones sticking up for the white girls. Anyway, you're under fire at the moment, my friend, and there's been this big sort of rush of publicity for you at the moment because you are one of the main people featuring in some left-wing documentary starring a woman called My Vingren. Is that how you pronounce it?
My. Yeah, My Vingren.
It's spelt My, but My. Is that how you... I'm just going to call her My, because I'm not going to get this pronunciation right. And if I keep making that strange noise all night, it'll get clipped out and people say, well, I've gone insane. So anyway, it's got this woman, and she's said she's hacking hate. So she's attempted to sort of infiltrate groups that you were part of and the wider sort of Swedish ethno-nationalist movement with fake profiles, etc. So she was too lazy to actually get off her arse and go and meet any of you and speak to you. But instead, she's misrepresented herself in order to get information that she feels will harm you. But along the way, she's also scandalously tried to get access to private pictures of your children, your family. And this is an absolute scandal. But tell us all about it, mate, because you've got the floor tonight. And I want to let you tell your whole story and let the audience know what you've gone through.
Yeah, so to be honest, like, it's in the grand scheme of things, for every time stuff like this happens, I will get some publicity. Many people, they will come to my channel, they will see for themselves, and then they think, okay, they say that he's hateful, but clearly we don't find anything hateful. And I made a video as well, I suppose many have seen it already, but I say, you know, I challenge anyone to fact check me here, go through all of my videos, my podcasts, read my books, and I'm taking the opportunity to promote my own books there and podcasts. So but anyway, I'm saying, like, okay, you can look through my content here, there isn't really anything hateful for it in it. It's based on, you know, love for my own, as cliche as that might sound, but it's the legitimate truth, and everyone can tell it who actually looks at the content. So it's now here's something to note as well. I don't know exactly what she's saying in the video, and this is what they're doing, Swedish journalists, or I suppose all left-wing journalists. They don't necessarily say anything, they don't necessarily lie outright, but they use the sort of psychological mechanisms to make you be seen as some unpleasant guy. So they might have a picture or a video sequence, and then they put on some really dark music, like, here is the right-wing extremist influencer, dun dun dun, and it's very sinister all the time. So they try to present you as something sinister, and this causes the effect when someone actually looks at my videos, especially where I'm a bit more jolly, you know, these happy upbeat videos, when I'm just positive, it sort of creates a very it detracts from their I was going to say gravitas, but they don't really have any gravitas to begin with. But their credibility, at least, it detracts from it when people can see it for themselves. So, yes, I could say I'm under fire because I'm quite sure they will show this documentary in schools. But the young guys, I mean, they've been doing this for maybe not 10 years, but say 8 years, something like that. They've shown videos of me in school saying like, oh, this is a danger because you will be radicalized. And, you know, the guys who are attracted to the message, they're going to be that anyway. And no one else really cares. So the left wing extremists, they already hate me. They will continue to hate me. The ones who are normal, they will be curious, look for themselves. But yeah, as you say, she tried to make so she even shows it in the trailer that when she creates this AI generated faces. So she took a picture of her AI generated face of a man, Mjölner Hammaren, so Mjölner Hammer. And then she tried to follow Julia's private account, which, yeah, it says this is a private account for friends and family and, you know, our children. So it was quite creepy, to be honest, that she tried to gain access to that. And I think there might be some psychological issue going on as well, because he went quite far in creating this like AI family for herself. So she created like the wife, the husband, children as well. So it a bit crazy vibes for sure.
Does she have children? Does she have a husband?
No. So there might
be. She's about 40, isn't she?
Yeah. So
do you think she's one of these? I mean, look, I don't want to jump in here, but you know, you've got to psychologically analyze some of these people, you know, and have an insight into their lives. And you know, she's. To put it politely, I mean, she's an odd-looking woman. And, you know, she clearly hasn't met anyone in life who has she's clicked with or anything like that. She hasn't had children. It's probably unlikely she'll have children now at that age. Once a woman hits 40, her fertility, you know, declines to around 5%. Do you think some of her hatred and animus to people like you and your lovely wife and your family is the fact that you're living this healthy, clean life, and you've got the things that somewhere deep inside her she knows she's missing and she resents?
Yeah, especially when she tries to involve my wife with it as well. It becomes quite clear, just, you know, comparing the two. So yeah, definitely there is that component. And if you want to go deeper into it, maybe I don't know about her life, but fully possible that she hasn't had an easy life based on it. Maybe she has felt rejected by Swedish men, creating a sort of hatred, because I know she's posted that all whites are ugly and, you know, very many hateful things against whites, especially men. So I think there is a psychological issue that she doesn't feel part of the Swedish people. And then, of course, she wants revenge. So it's a quite common phenomenon. So I think that's the likeliest scenario, that she has been, you know, felt unloved, unwanted by Swedish men. And then she sees me as a representative of Swedish men. I am the Swedish man. And then, you know, project her hatred on me because I am the sort of, yeah, archetypical Swedish man. So I believe that to be the case. And of course, she can feel, you know, if she goes with that hate inside of her, then she noticed that, okay, this left-wing university professors, they say that I am actually the good person here. I am actually the right person in this moral dilemma. And these white men, they are actually the bad ones. So she goes in with that hatred because maybe she has been rejected. And then she gets that confirmation from this left-wing professors. So to keep in mind here as well that Sweden has been very, very left-wing for a long time. We were very, very right-wing for a long time. And then, you know, the pendulum swings. And Sweden is much like England. I mean, Sweden and England, very, very similar countries. So you will recognize most of this. Every Englishman will recognize this as well. We have this moral, very strong moral thing. So you had the English Civil War with Cromwell and these guys, the Puritans. We have the same streak in Sweden, this Puritan streak. So going from one end of the spectrum of being more right-wing with, you know, strongly nationalistic, and then to the completely opposite side. And there we have a very strong current of, cultural Marxism or left-wing extremism or whatever you want to call it. So Sweden was, of course, not part of the Soviet bloc, but we've been very red, so social democratic, for the last 100 years or so. So it's been a default position to view any type of nationalism with, you know, hostility. So it's an easy way for someone who goes in with hostility, a hatred against people of her own group because he hasn't felt accepted. Again, I'm just speculating now. I might be wrong, but this could be the case that she hasn't felt, you know, loved and embraced and accepted and on the team, so to speak, on the Team Sweden, Team Europe. So therefore, she wants to lash out. And she sees this ideology, window dressing, whatever you want to call it. And then she can, you know, rationalize and say, she is the good person. She gets to harass normal people, and she is the good person because all white men are bad. So, definitely.
You know, you see, I look at these people and I think they accuse us of hate. And this is sort of tangential. We'll get back to your story and all of this. But I do think this is an interesting point, that they accuse us so much of, you know, being the haters, wanting to stir hate. But the leftists I've met have genuinely been motivated by hate. They despise normal people. They despise healthy society. You know, they're the people that sat there and didn't perform well in sports, so hated the fit, the healthy, the strong. You know, they're the girls that despise the beautiful, the ones who were, you know, outgoing and attractive. And I think that kind of, that hatred manifested, and it was used by communists and leftists to turn people against healthy society. And when I look at somebody like her, I can imagine that being the case. So with this woman then, what has she actually done in terms of gathering information, and how well did she integrate or infiltrate your organizations?
As far as I've understood it, she hasn't really infiltrated anything. She's created these profiles and then followed. Her research is, she's been watching my videos and, you know, partaking of content by others. So research, investigative journalism, not really. I mean, everything is in the open as well. And I've said this, I mean, I'm not going to have some secret meeting with anyone. I want my message to be heard as many people as possible. And that's also why they want to censor us. And that's why you are censored, because they don't want your message to go out there. So it's not like we have some secret meetings where we, you know, have, talk about metapolitics. We want a big, big audience all the time. So, I don't think she has done anything or infiltrated anything. Just, you know, partaken of content, as far as I've understood it, at least. So,
Well, that's interesting then, because you see the way this has been put forward, and look, I'm not an expert on it. I had a cursory glance online, and I saw what I saw was her and the man who's behind all of this, because she's not actually the person who's behind all this, but her and the guy who's behind all this, you know, they were at a film festival. It was premiered there. There was this big deal about it. You know, people were calling it this sort of visionary documentary. It's been panned on IMDb, but it's got pretty, healthy reviews on Rotten Tomatoes. But the way she's talking about it is as if she's gone like deep, deep, deep undercover. And in reality, all she's done is watched content online that's freely available and anyone can watch. So how is she being able to claim this is investigative journalism? I mean, really, you know, there's people tonight who've probably watched all of your content over the last few years. Has she done anything different to that?
I don't think so. I don't think so. And I mean, I wouldn't, you know, maybe she has tried to talk to someone. Maybe she has tried to you know, start up a DM conversation on Instagram or whatever it might be, you know, under the guise of being a Swedish housewife or something like that, and, you know, try to get the information, just views, because the information is like no one is doing anything illegal anyway. So it's not like she can infiltrate a group that is planning something, because the planning is like the plan is the red pill people, and then we want to reach out to as many people as possible. So nothing is really hidden, everything is in the open. So I mean, the struggle for us is try to reach as many people as possible. It's not to hide our views. So the thing is really like just strange to me. So the most accurate, I mean, had I been her, were I to write a documentary or create a documentary on something, I would just like to go and watch as much of the content as possible that is open, because that's ultimately perhaps the most potent content. Then, of course, you can have stuff behind paywalls, but that's maybe a, you know, deep dive into a book or something like that. But the investigation, it just strikes me as really odd to even claim that, because there isn't really much to investigate. You know, she could investigate, okay, what are our motives? Yes, our motives is that we don't want to see European children being raped. That's a motivation. I don't think she takes that into her documentary, though. But yeah, who knows?
Yeah, you see, I find all this quite interesting, because it was like with the BBC, who've just done this sort of undercover sting on Patriotic Alternative and myself and others. And really, you know, they could, you know, any journalist that wants to openly debate with me over these issues can just call me. And I will sit and I've never denied any journalist the chance to sit with me and to discuss these issues. It's as simple as that. I'm more than happy to do that. And what I find odd about this is usually, so in the UK, there's always at least one undercover operation going on at any one time, potentially more. So we just had an undercover documentary that was based on Britain First and sort of the international conferencing movement. And that was shown towards the end of last year. And whilst that was being made, the BBC were making a documentary about my group and the anti-migrant protest. So at any one time, there is always at least one of these documentaries being made about various groups. And the draw of this is that usually they have some undercover footage of somebody saying something that's a bit spicy. So with the last one, with the Britain First documentary, they followed Paul Golding and his close lieutenants to Poland, where they went to the independence march and said a few spicy things, dropping the N-word, etc. But what I don't understand about this is, what's the actual draw of this documentary? What's the point of it when everything's public domain? This isn't like for example, let's say she had come into the movement as an undercover journalist and she got close with you, befriended you. You two were going out and doing forest runs, going to the gym. She was attending events with you, and you start to confide in her. And she's like, this is the real golden one. Like, that would be a draw. That would be something that would be like, ooh, you know, it's a little bit salacious. It's a little bit interesting. But this, it's just like, well, I binged on all of his YouTube videos, and this is what I think, you know. And to do it from behind, you know, she didn't even really need to set up a fake profile to watch her YouTube videos, did she?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is fun. I always joke with my mates that, you know, Säpo, so the Swedish Security Service, they will be quite disappointed when they hear our actual conversation, you know, in the sauna, if we're talking about, you know, what could be whatever. We're talking about Warhammer or demons or, you know, Age of Empires or whatever it might be. So they want to have this juicy, spicy, like, oh, we're gonna do this and that, but all we talk about is, you know, completely different stuff. So and yeah, if anyone tried to infiltrate anything, you know, come, if I host an open training and if someone comes, mainly guys, of course, but if a guy comes there, I mean, what he will see is basically what you see online. There's nothing really different. And if someone comes to talk about illegal stuff, I'm just going to confront him about it and say, like, why would you talk about this? Because that's not the path to victory anyway. So this is also something that I always try to emphasize, that there is a way for young men to ventilate. And I understand this. I understand young men are angry. They need to ventilate. They want change now. So they talk tough. They talk, this should be done, this, that should be done. But they haven't been part of, they haven't been politically active for 5 years, 10 years, let alone, 15 years, 20 years like you. And they talk tough early on. I know that some guys might do it, but it's also a red flag, because why would anyone do that? It's not the path to victory. Our path to victory lies in imposing our moral framework on others, and that we can only do if we have, access to the public space. So any talk of nefarious activities, illegal activities, it only ever serves the regime, because they want us there. They want us to have in a nice, comfortable box in the outskirts of society. They don't want us to present a moral argument for our nations, because that's ultimately the struggle at hand. As I said, both England, Sweden, very moral nations. We do what we deem moral. So all of these boomers who love third worlders, they did it because it felt right. The boomers in Sweden, especially them, they did it. They wanted half of Africa living on welfare in Sweden because it felt right for them. It was a moral act, because they had been taught, especially, with the 68 revolution of left-wing thought, they thought, okay, what can we do to atone for this great sin of being white? Yes, we can bring them here, take them together. The motherly instinct was turned towards third worlders instead. So if anyone asks, why does it look like this? I know there are other factors as well, definitely. But the main thing, the main culprit I always point to, it pains me, but it's also a good way. It's good to point to the psychological mechanism within our own people, because that's also the key to turning this around. And the key is then to say to everyone that the moral thing to do is to, protect our girls, simply put. Protect our girls from getting raped by foreign rape gangs. That is the moral thing to do. And the moral thing can only be accomplished by a large-scale re-migration process. So our great goal is that. It's not to create some small-scale mischief to feel cool. And this is something all younger guys need to know as well. I know what it's like to be younger, to want to feel a bit rebellious and cool, but if you're really serious about it, you need to just, as a Roman testudo, put your shield up, march in discipline over many, many years. That's how we win. We don't win by doing anything silly.
Well, I agree. And this is one of the things that I often find frustrating, is there's usually somebody at an event who will say something which, if recorded, may bring the other people at the event into disrepute. And I think the issue for me is those people, it is up to them what they say. But by saying it at an event with other people there, they put those other people in jeopardy. So, for example, if you and I were to attend an event later this year in a European country, and we were there giving speeches, and there was somebody there, who had a few too many to drink and started espousing pretty crazy stuff, whether or not we've spoken to that person, whether we know his name, whether we've ever had any contact with him, those words, if secretly recorded, sort of tarnish everyone at the event. And I think the thing that worries me at the moment, both here in the UK and abroad, is that increasingly the establishment is desperate to sort of, how can I say, conflate hot-headed words with, literal terrorism. And you see this in the UK at the moment. We're seeing it, on the continent. And I think as the establishment gets more and more desperate and lashes out, they will be willing to take harsher measures against people just for associating with someone who said something silly. And I ask people, if you are attending nationalist events, or if you are in comment sections, etc., if you're going to say something stupid, keep it to yourself, because you're not helping us in any way. And as Marcus said, we need to take this message to a wider a number of people, we can't just ghettoize ourselves in the corner of the internet where we post, you know, increasingly, you know, if you like, I don't like the term extreme, but sort of, you know, you get into this cycle of, you know, purity spiraling, and you post ever more outrageous things to the point where eventually, you know, no one's listening except for the hardcore. And then the journalists have got everything they need.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. So something I usually say, something I think to myself, is that everything I say or write, so even if my, you know, I can say, not even write or record online or anything, but everything I say can be heard by Zappo, because I don't know if my phone is tapped or whatever, but I'm just counting on it because it's best. So I'm not going to use any of these words anyway, because that's not part of my plan anyway. So everything you say or write online, and this is, of course, you know, most guys with normal intelligence, they will already know this. But it's good to remind everyone, like, everything you write online, it will be seen by others. You don't have any privacy online. That's just, and it doesn't matter if it's on Signal or Telegram or wherever it might be. It will be seen. So don't say anything stupid either. And also, as you say, Mark, for any young guy, if you want to ventilate, don't do it, because it doesn't help. It doesn't help that you write an edgy comment. Instead, write an actually dangerous comment. An actually dangerous comment is a well-composed, eloquent case, a moral case for remigration. That is what they don't want. And that's also why they need these thug-like characters to point to and see, this is how a nationalist is supposed to be. So they take this American History X and Romper Stomper, or these films, this is how you're supposed to be as a nationalist, because it's very comfortable for them. What's not comfortable is someone like you, Mark, handsome and well-spoken, so you can't be on X, because you're too handsome and well-spoken, so you can't be there, because it's you're shattering their narrative. Be as well-spoken as possible, and people will listen. And always make the moral argument. That is the key. You can, of course, always make economic arguments, but at the end of the day, and this is something we've seen, it became very clear in Sweden, because at first it was, you know, we need all of these migrants to save the economy, to save pensions. And then, you know, everyone sort of understood, yeah, no, it's not really the case. But then they had to, like, say, open your hearts. So this was an infamous speech by Fredrik Reinfeldt, previous prime minister. So he said, you know, he admitted more or less, we know it's not, you know, economically viable, but open your hearts instead. So it's always this moral reasoning. That's the end of the line of any argument, that it's moral to do. So same thing for us. We can say, yeah, it doesn't matter if we need to pay higher prices of getting your fast food driven out to your house. Yes, it will be twice as expensive. It doesn't matter, because it's a moral argument to make that our homelands belong to us, and we don't want to constantly fare for the safety of our children. That is the ultimate moral argument to make.
I agree. And I think that when we are discussing these things, there's a wealth of data. So I put in the show notes tonight, there's been another case of a gang of migrants who raped a woman, and they've been given 15 months. And the judge has basically said, oh, they didn't really understand, you know, Western culture. You know, they needed guidance on how to function in our society. Now, this has taken place in Holland. You know, 15 months for a gang rape is ridiculous, you know. But the issue is, when you look at all the data, migrants are committing these sexual crimes at a much higher rate than the indigenous people in Sweden or the indigenous people in the UK. And the moral argument is clear. If you want to protect Swedish women and British women, if you want your people to be safe, you need to close the borders. Now, by letting those people in, you are raising the risk for females in our countries. And there is a sensible moral argument that can be backed up with a wealth of evidence, you know, especially the grooming gangs here in the UK, where you're talking over, you know, some people have estimated up to 1 million victims. And when you're looking at that, it's easy to make a moral argument without resorting to sort of racial slurs, or without resorting to swearing and going mad and turning yourself into a parody of the sort of, you know, extreme, angry, right-wing you know, guy, because that's literally what they want you to be. Now, I believe, and you kindly said this about me, I believe they banned me off Twitter because I'm very good at normalizing and articulating the points we make. And when I used to do my YouTube videos, I was good at that as well. You know, I could reduce things down to simple analogies so anyone would understand. And I've been blocked everywhere. And I think they fear that. Whereas you see some of the mad accounts that are still operating on Twitter, and you think to yourself, well, those accounts are clearly far more outrageous, saying things on a daily basis that are far more outrageous than anything I've ever said. But I feel like sometimes they're there, you know, for a reason, in the same way that I'm not there for a reason.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, something else I thought to say also, they do fear you. They fear your pen or your capacity of articulating yourself. And this is also for all young men. If you want to train something, it's of course always important to train your physique and train everything, you train your fists, but the pen is in this case mightier than the sword. So if you want to train at something, train to be as effective as at communicating as possible, because it's truly an art. It's truly an art to, especially on Twitter, to just compose something that really clicks with people. And I see this as well when I, you know, if I analyze a nicely written text or a text, it can be just, you know, a post, a few lines, and I say how much, I see how much information it got into that particular post and how well he hit on different like keynotes. He got in a moral thing there. So view yourself as a connoisseur of rhetoric, and you will prosper. So that will get you not only in terms of politics, but when it comes to maybe if you want to find a lady, ladies, you know, they love someone with a good grasp of the language. You know, you can sing poetry to her as well if you want. So, you know, being able to talk for yourself is supremely important. So, yeah, definitely something to train. And as you say, Mark, and as I said, you're too eloquent. That's why you're not allowed there. So, yeah.
Well, thank you very much. So do you think this documentary will lead to any sort of legal or other issues for you or groups in Sweden? Because obviously last year we saw the American State Department's outrageous classification of Nordic Resistance as a terrorist group when they've never committed a terrorist act and they actually stand in elections and they're, you know, they are legal and above board. But they put them in a position now where people from overseas, you know, can't really work with them or support them. And they're sort of, you know, isolated because of this outrageous decision. And often you will have somebody like this, Mai Wingren, who's obviously a celebrated sort of, you know, crackpot leftist journalist with a chip on her shoulder. They will make something like this, and it will be a precursor to either new legislation or to some kind of investigation or even political interference with people such as yourselves. Do you think there will be any follow-up to this, or do you think it'll just be something that disappears?
It's always hard to say. It depends on how... I mean, it really depends on who is in charge for the different... I mean, I've lost accounts before. So, I mean, this has been an ongoing process for a long time. So, I mean, it's the same as usual. I know I will keep losing things, gain some other things, gain popularity, but take more heat from the establishment. So it's same as usual. I mean, you know how it is. You know, you create an account, build a following, it gets shut down. You create another account somewhere else. So it's same old story.
You see, I get bored with the whole whack-a-mole thing. I mean, somebody sent me a couple of links the other day to Mark Collett on TikTok, and none of them are really me, and they're all pushing, like, the Trump stuff. But, you know, when it comes down to it, I get bored of creating new accounts. Occasionally, I do it. So I started a second Twitter account, and it got whack-a-moled at around 4,000 followers. And, you know, it just, you know, as soon as it starts to get a little bit of traction and you've got tweets going a little bit viral, they notice you and they whack you down. But yeah, it's good that you think that's the extent of it, that it might just be, you know, issues with social media, etc. Because in this country, often when things happen like these documentaries, you have a load of bank accounts closed down, you have people's money sort of temporarily seized, etc., etc., etc. And it makes life very difficult. And Another thing that I do tend to find is when these things do come out, there are people that get very scared and decide that the movement's no longer for them, that, you know, they're worried that maybe their family could be exposed or their job could be affected in some way. And you do see what certain nationalists call the timids, you know, sort of jump ship and scurry away. I don't know how effective this will be in that respect, or how famous this woman truly is, but they are certainly making a big deal of it. And, you know, I don't also, the interesting thing with people like yourself, and this is the final thing I'll say before I throw it back to you, is I used to know the Swedish Democrats. They used to come to BNP events and they were very much ethno-nationalists, but now they're not. They are in a position of power, but I can't imagine them defending your freedom of speech.
So we'll see. It will be an interesting development. I know there are better Sweden Democrats and there are worse Sweden Democrats. But I would say also about the social thing, the social stigma, it's nowhere near as bad as it was 10, 20 years ago. So being called something now, people will say, so I had a friend, I have a friend, and he was the subject of a hit piece only 2-3 weeks ago. And they put him with, you know, full face, saying this guy, he works as a security guard at this highly, you know, important place. And then he lumped the journalist, left-wing extremist as well. He lumped him together with actual criminals. But, you know, my friend said absolutely no negative thing came out of it. He got a lot of support from his bosses, from all of his colleagues, many of which are non-Europeans, by the way, which is fun. They've cried wolf so many times, so people don't really care so much about it anymore. And especially when it comes to, you know, normal people and conservatives. So we're talking about guys in the moderates or the Sweden Democrats. They aren't as jumpy anymore. They aren't as timid anymore because they've sort of grown tired of it. So they don't place as much emphasis on it anymore. But that's not to say that a hit piece isn't damaging. Of course it is. But at least the social thing, it was worse back in the day. But I would also say for the Sweden Democrats, you have like two different factions within the party, or many different factions, but you have those who are more, you know, committed to Sweden and the Swedes. And then you have some guys in the Sweden Democrats who are very, very anti-Muslim. So they are, you know, posting about how great Israel is every other day, stuff like that. So which is a bit strange. There was a Sweden Democratic guy who went to Israel and he completely embarrassed himself. He fell on the knees before two settlers and called them martyrs, something like that. It was completely, completely embarrassing. But anyway, I can only hope that now they are in sort of a position of power. They have a special agreement called Tidöavtalet. So it's sort of an agreement with the moderates, because the Sweden Democrats, they actually got bigger. They got more votes than the moderates, but the moderates, they are still the main party in the coalition. So it's a bit of a, it's not a stable coalition, but they agree on certain things. So there's only so much they can do, the Sweden Democrats, but I do know that there are good people in the party who would probably be interested in, you know, safekeeping freedom of speech, because they would lose big time if freedom of speech goes away as well. So the interesting part now is that we have an election in not this autumn, but next year's autumn. And then we'll see. It's going to be a very important election. I think the Social Democrats, they might win, because the current conservative government, they haven't done enough to halt the giving out of citizenships, because the citizenships, they all basically go to people they know will vote for the Social Democrats. So they're basically just bringing in voters. So it's a battle against time. So yeah, we'll see. Interesting times ahead, at least.
So you at the moment, you also did a sort of a bit of a heartfelt piece recently where you said that, you know, in some respects you wish you'd become, you know, more political, or potentially did you know, live slightly differently, because obviously, you know, you see certain political change on the horizon, and you're in a way locked out of that because you could probably never join the Sweden Democrats. I actually disagree with you on that. And I nearly did a rebuttal, but I didn't want to seem disrespectful. I nearly did a rebuttal because I wanted to come and sort of put you in a headlock and scream at you and tell you just sort of how I think the work that you've done is far more valuable than merely standing in elections. And, you know, when... You know, I spent a decade of my life doing the electoral thing, you know, to build it up and see it broken down again. And I always find that when it comes to elections, there's sort of two paths you can tread. One, you sell out by quite a large degree in order to get somewhere, like the Sweden Democrats did, or you sort of stick to your guns, and over time you just get broken down and you pour thousands of pounds or millions of pounds into something and don't get anywhere. And I've always found that the output that you have consistently produced ever since I've become aware of you has been one of the most white-pilling, upbeat and genuinely inspiring content. You know, you're never negative, you're never rude, you're never lewd about anything. You always have a positive outlook. Your aesthetics are always brilliant. And I always wanted to, as I said, I didn't want to do a rebuttal to you because sometimes rebuttals can seem disrespectful or like you're trying to get drama going, which I'm certainly not because you're a good friend of mine. But I always wanted to say to you that I think that what you've done in your political career is far more important than merely being a name on a ballot paper somewhere. And I think you've made real social change.
Thank you very much. Yeah, so what I meant, I'm going to dispel any illusions you had about me being humble. I wasn't being humble, so I didn't say that I should have gone into politics. I said that I wish I had encouraged others to go into politics. So I'm saying that for me personally, I'm better suited to, you know, doing my thing. So I'm not saying I'm not regretting the path I've taken. I'm just regretting that I didn't encourage young guys to go into political parties. So I should have stressed, you know, my usual points like go to the gym, stop watching porn, read books. And then I should have added go into a political party. So, I mean, for me personally, my personality type, my looks, everything, I'm well suited to do what I've done. So I didn't mean that I should have, you know, skipped all of my work and just, you know, gone into politics. I just wish others would have done that. And going into politics, yes, I understand. I've heard from men such as yourself, I greatly respect. Yes, it will be a lot of sacrifices going into politics. It will be many hours that you feel like you might have wasted. But still, I still want all of these young talents to be in politics. Then there are young talents, they can do other things. There are investigative journalists in, you know, on our side as well. We have two really good ones, Nick Alinia and Christian Petersson here in Sweden. They really take it to the leftists, they expose them. So if you have that inclination, by all means do that. Or if you have some other talent, do that. But if you aren't sure, but if you want to do something, join a youth party and stay in there. And then suddenly in 10 years time, hopefully if 100 guys in Sweden or Norway, or I know it might be a bit harder in the UK based on how UK society looks like, but you know, in many countries, it can be done at least to have many of these individuals, because that's ultimately how the standard liberals have done it. They go into these parties and then they determine the future. So why can't we do the same? Why can't we go in and, you know, make a cultural shift in those parties?
Well, I think there's a big difference. You see, for me, in the UK, I think there's only one party that can possibly affect any change that is outside of the current mainstream. And that's the Reform Party. But the Reform Party are a huge gulf away from being ethno-nationalists. Now, I think people could go into the Reform Party. I think they could speak openly about migration, about a desire for some form of remigration, and they could potentially end up doing very well or even winning a parliamentary seat. However, the issue is, I'm sort of more talking about in the UK right now, starting a small ethno-nationalist party or going up against the likes of Reform is almost undoable. So I would say it's similar in Sweden in that if somebody was to go sort of, if somebody was to hide their power levels and join the Sweden Democrats, I think they would have a pathway toward influence. And that may work. But I don't think there's going to be any explicit ethno-nationalist party in Sweden that's going to go up against the Swedish Democrats, come out favorably and espouse the more open ethno-nationalist politics that you and I discuss. So I think you either show your power level, do community building, do the things that we do, or you hide a little bit of what you believe and join a group like, say, the AFD, the RN in France, or Sweden Democrats or Reform.
So something to keep in mind as well is that I know a lot of bad optics have come out from the Sweden Democrats over the last few years, but they are quite radical in many good ways. So one of their top guys, Richard Jomshof, again, he's a proper, you know, counter-jihadist, and he thinks perhaps too well of Israel, but he still, he promotes, and he's one of the top guys in SD, and he said, you know, 800,000 individuals need to be deported, something like that. And that's a quite high high number. The alternative for Sweden, they proposed like 500,000, so 300,000 less. And this Richard Jomshof guy, he goes out to say, you know, almost 1 million people need to leave Sweden. Sweden is only like 10 million in population. So it's a quite radical thing to say. So, I mean, the shift in the Sweden Democrats, it's been quite significant over the last 5 years. You couldn't say remigration or återvandring, as it's called in Sweden. You couldn't say that 5 years ago. But now I think most of them are talking about it. You have guys in Moderaterna, so that's the default conservative or conservative party. They are also talking about it, you know, expelling foreign criminals. And that's also 5 years ago. You couldn't say that. So you can change also, you know, the people who are already in the party. So I want to see the good people in the Sweden Democrats and the moderates. I want them to have support by fresh blood coming in to the youth party, coming in and supporting, because there is a power struggle in these parties also. You have individuals who want to bring SD, Sweden Democrats, more to become a mainstream conservative party. And then you have genuine people who want SD as a, you know, proper proper way to restore order in Sweden. And same thing I say to young guys, you know, you could join Moderaterna, the moderates, because they don't really have a sound, they don't really have a stable ideological grounding. So you can go in and say, I am a conservative and I am for law and order, and be perfectly, you know, honest about it. And say, why wouldn't we be able to, in the moderates, why wouldn't we be able to secure the border? Isn't this part of the party tradition? I mean, it could be done. It could be done. So, and also something to keep in mind is that anyone who goes into politics, it doesn't necessarily be need to be explicitly ethno-nationalist. You can create ethno-nationalist policies on a, you know, completely non-ethnic level. You can just say, all foreign criminals go out, everyone on welfare goes out. Then, of course, it's better if people are open with saying that, you know, the foundation of Swedish society is Swedish blood. But you can still implement ethno-nationalist policies without being explicitly ethno-nationalist. Because ultimately, if you say that you're going to expel people on welfare, and you have, I can't say which countries because I don't want to get taken down for hate speech or anything, because yeah, we don't have freedom of speech, but yeah, you can implement policies to restore Sweden to a better demographic. So
we have a situation in the UK where we're far more overpopulated than you are. So the population density of the UK is more than sort of 10 times that of Sweden. So you've got about 26 people per square kilometre, and we've got about 280 people per square kilometre. So, you know, vastly more overpopulated. I mean, my thing with the issues of remigration is obviously that has to be the political aim. That has to be the political aim. But there also has to be a degree of political realism. So the problem we've got in Britain is we have 10 years left until white Britons are a minority in the age group of 5 to 16 year olds. So that is very, very worrying. You know, at the moment, white Britons are just 61.3% of the school population. That means there's nearly 40% of those in British schools are foreign or of an ethnic minority background. And once you hit that point where you're a minority in schools, it's only a matter of time before that filters into the rest of society, because those people are going to grow up. They are going to be the ones breeding, and you are going to face an irreversible, you know, problem. And my issue with all of this is I think nationalists need to be more focused on potentially planning, like in places like Germany, France and the UK, we need to be more focused, and especially America, we need to be more focused on what happens as that transition takes place, rather than attempting to stop, you know, throwing all our eggs into the basket of attempting to stop something that we very may well be powerless to stop and have really very little agency in, because it's too far along. So I always used to remember Nick Griffin in the BNP saying, this is our last chance to stop it. And he was very, you know, me and him don't talk anymore. You know, we're not on the same page. But he used to always talk about the fact that between sort of 2000 and 2010, that was really the last chance to build a genuine ethno-nationalist movement and turn things around. Because he would say, you know, the next sort of 10, 15 years, we're going to hit a point where there is a tipping, like a falling birth rate, rising immigration. And at that point, everything's set in motion. And undoing that is very, very difficult. And he might actually have been wrong. It might be that the last chance to do it in that way was actually the 1970s or 80s. Now, I think things might be different in Sweden, because when I last saw you in Sweden, I couldn't get over how white Stockholm was compared to London. You know, you guys talk about your ethnic problem, but come to London and you'll see an ethnic problem.
Yeah, so basically this is, of course, a huge difference between Sweden and many other countries such as the UK, France, America. We do have, you know, my thoughts often go out to Swedes who live in, you know, they haven't been able to get away from the multicultural health projects. So in schools, for example, or if you need to go on public transit in, you know, late at night. So I was actually on the subway the other day. But it was early in the morning and it was like completely white, quiet, really nice. So in Sweden, you can still avoid the multicultural society to a large extent, depending on where you live. And this is, of course, also it means that you can escape it in certain places. But then again, you have happenings all the time. You know, a hand grenade gets thrown into a shopping mall, or a shooting is on the street. So Sweden is still white, but it's a gangster's paradise, which means that it's good for, you know, political dissidents, because it's not as repressive as the UK, for example. But it also means that actual criminals can, you know, have their, you know, be a bit wilder, so to speak. So that is the main issue. But in Sweden's case, I'm quite white-pilled, because it could be, you know, the course of destiny here could be changed quite quickly. It just matters of political will. So yeah, I know it's different in the UK. So usually my advice, maybe it's better suited to places like Scandinavia and some other continental European countries. But we'll see. My hope, at least for Sweden and for other places. And of course, as I said to another prominent and heroic man the other day, I shall not name his name, but perhaps he's watching this, I don't know, I said that Sweden, once we take back Sweden, we will try our best to come and save our European brothers as well.
Maybe. I mean, I you know, I think there are places that can turn this around, and I think there's definitely places in Eastern Europe where they can take a leaf out of our book and say, hey, look, you know, I can see what happened there. We don't want it to happen here. And it does hearten me that several Eastern European countries, I think Russia also did it, tried to get their young sort of ethnically indigenous people to start breeding. I know that that has been tried in some places, which is good. But I look at places like America, and America are now under 60%, what they call, well, America have very weird census. So the American census will say that whites are 73%, but what they class as white only is around 60%, probably under that now. But white only means of European descent. White means, you know, so includes mixed race, certain Hispanics, etc. But actual Europeans, as in, you know, founding stock, they are now just under 60%, maybe worse. And I've spoken to several American ethno-nationalists who have said, look, you know, it's likely that whites, as in Europeans, founding stock, are under 50% in American schools already. So I definitely think that there needs to be different organization based on where you live. And I favor sort of building communities, clustering together, building power bases and going from there. And I think in your country, you know, I've obviously spoken to Dan Erickson, and I think his Free Sweden project is really, really good. The idea of entire villages of ethnic Swedes, you know, out there together in the summer doing, you know, traditional dance, getting together for barbecues, etc. I think stuff like that, I found that quite inspiring, to be honest.
Yeah, let me just cast aside my humility for a moment. I am the Swedish master. My team is the Swedish master in kubb. So kubb is like a traditional Swedish like game. So you throw like wooden sticks at the other players, not at the players, but at their sticks. Anyway, hard to explain, but so we had.
Oh, we play it here. I've played it.
Oh, you
we
have.
Played
okay,
at
nice.
PA events. We've actually played right. PA events. Yeah.
Nice. So yeah, we have the current, and I will, me and my team, we will defend our title next summer for the annual summer feast. So yeah, by Dan Eriksson and the Free Sweden Project.
It's great that you know him and you're working with him, because as I say, I find that really inspirational that they are actually moving to areas and creating these little ethnic enclaves where they can be around themselves. And, you know, I was really heartened by a discussion he had with me where he was saying that when they first moved there, some of the locals weren't sure. But after a while, when they'd taken over sort of, you know, local associations and when doing good community events, you know, the Swedes in those areas got on board with them. And I think that's absolutely fantastic. So, yeah. Anyway, we're going to the second hour. You said you might not be able to stay around for the whole of the show, but we have got some super chats for you. So we'll do them first. And if you have to shoot off, you have to shoot off. Glenn19 gave $3. Thank you so much. He said, Mr. Folin, you are a much better role model than Andrew Tate. And like Tate, you are married with children. One would only follow Andrew Tate if you need advice on how to sex traffic women. I'm surprised he isn't in prison.
Yeah, Andrew Tate, fight me. Fight me, Andrew Tate. That's all I have to say.
Look, you would easily win that. And people who say that Marcus wouldn't have never actually been in a fight. I've met Marcus, and he doesn't look particularly big tonight because of the way the camera's positioned. But in real life, he is a big guy. And a moderately skilled big guy will easily beat a highly skilled smaller guy just because of body mass. And no matter how good you think Tate is, Marcus is about twice as big as him. It'd be like hitting somebody
I'd say we're equal size. And besides, we would fight
really?
We would fight in a weight class as well. So it doesn't really matter. We would be the same size going in. So yeah, I mean, it doesn't matter. I just want to fight him because I think he gets a lot of the fame I should have had because of all the censorship over the years. So it's sort of like my way to at least get back some of that. I might make a public video soon. You know, I've made on Twitter, you know, calling out, saying, you know, in a quite respectful way, I don't want to be rude about it. I want to be, you know, a serious offer. Like, yeah, if you want to fight, we can do it. It will be entertaining. Perhaps one day I will be at the top of Swedish society, so then you can tell your grandchildren that you fought the great Primarch of Sweden. So I need to sell it somehow to him. But yeah,
You do look a lot bigger than him.
Yeah, nay, but we would fight the same weight anyway, so it doesn't matter. But it would be nice, and I feel that it would be fun. So yeah, I might make a public call out.
It always sort of reminds me when small guys, it's like when Conor McGregor, I think he called out Brock Lesnar or said something about Brock Lesnar. And it's like, it doesn't matter how good somebody of Conor McGregor's size is. Brock Lesnar is like four times his size. And, you know, just Brock Lesnar's just like an animal. You know, to beat somebody that big, you have to be that big. You know, it's not a Marvel superhero film where, you know, basically a little girl knocks out like a 7 foot, you know, 300-pound monster. That's not how it works.
I mean, you could do it in the early 90s in the first UFC events, because then no one knew Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. So if you look at the first UFC events, the Royce Gracie, he goes in with his Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu gi and he submits others. But now, of course, everyone knows of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. But then everyone's like, oh, what is happening? He's choking me or he's breaking my arm. So
what's happening? My arm's broken. Yeah. Oh, my God.
So, it could happen there. I would also say, though, that when it comes to striking, size doesn't matter as much. But when it comes to wrestling, then it matters a lot. You know,
think strength. It doesn't matter in striking?
Everything matters. I mean, everything matters all the time. But it doesn't matter as much as it does in something with wrestling.
I disagree. I think that... I think in sort of like boxing, if you've got a heavyweight up against a bantamweight or somebody who's, you know, a featherweight, you literally are going to have the featherweight throwing punch after punch and it doing no damage. I can't remember the name of the guy, but Conor McGregor fought a Hispanic fella and everyone expected Conor McGregor to roll him over. But the weight difference just...
Oh, Nate Diaz.
Yeah, it's like the punches just, you know, the punches were raining down Nate Diaz and... They just didn't seem to have the effect they would have done if they were genuinely in the same weight class, because McGregor had to bulk up very quickly, which when you're bulking up quickly, you're not building any muscle. You're simply just adding weight via water or, you know, whatever you're shoving in your mouth. You know, I'd say that striking, whereas I say with wrestling, you know, obviously, if you're a skilled, you know, if you're really, really skilled, like Royce Gracie was, you could subdue a bigger guy wrestling. But I think it's probably, I'm taking the opposite point to you on this. I think that, like, being a striker, the weight you put behind a punch is just, you know, just incredible.
That's true, and that's also why heavyweights always knock each other out, because when you get that, you know, mass behind the momentum, it's truly something.
When you see a big guy, but yeah, I definitely pay to see you fight Andrew Tate, and if you did, I'd be in your corner. I'd be your corner man saying, have you Red Bull beforehand? get him there. DSalon7 gave $15. Thank you so much. Said, following the Neil Gaiman scandal has been both amusing and horrifying. A self-proclaimed feminist leftist darling who committed some of the most revolting crimes against women I've seen in a long time might be a good topic for one of your Friday videos, Mark. I haven't actually followed that, but it doesn't surprise me that these sort of leftist feminist males are actually the darkest of the predators. Now, it doesn't surprise me because I made a video about this once before, actually, how the worst thing you can have in your relationship is a beta male who's friends with your partner. So if your partner, your wife, your girlfriend, whatever you want to call it, has got a beta male friend who every time you argue with her, she goes to him for validation. That is a relationship ruining thing. That those men are just the worst of the worst. They're like little parasitical worms that wreck other men's lives. But I do think these sort of leftist feminist men, or these men that sort of play the beta male and sort of latch on as a girl's super friend, are actually just predators in waiting. You know, they're only doing it. You know, they're like, what are those, they're like a trapdoor spider, aren't they? They're just waiting to pounce when something walks past and, you know, it's a low moment. I don't know what you think of these leftist feminists, but I do think they've got dark agendas.
Yeah, definitely. So it's again like a way to say that I am actually, so they know they are spiteful, horrible people from the start, and then they try to, you know, find something to justify their worldview so they can hate on others. And then, of course, the hate, it takes on a, you know, it gets expressed in whatever manner. So in this case, I don't know, I haven't followed the scandal as well, but whenever someone says he's a male feminist, I know it's a bad person. It's someone who will eventually do very bad things to women. So yeah. So the main point I'm trying to say is that he probably has a very strange view of women, and then to sort of compensate for that, he says he's a feminist to try to hide it. So yeah, quite a simple psychological analysis there. I don't know if it's any interesting or not, but yeah, I don't
he
know.
Looks
every
like
time,
a oh. total freak. He looks like a total freak. Let's have a look at him. Let's have a look. Let's check his. Gaiman's family is of Polish, Jewish, and other Ashkenazi origins. His great family, his great grandfather emigrated to England from Antwerp before 1914. Da, 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 da. Yeah. So
is he the guy who wrote about Norse mythology?
I know. Neil Gaiman is an English author of short fiction, comic books, graphic novels, audio theatre and screenplays. His work includes the comic book series The Sandman and the novels Good Omens, Stardust, Anansi Boys, American Gods, Coraline and The Graveyard Book. I don't really know much about him, but...
I've only seen the cover and I thought, aha, maybe this looks good, but apparently he's just trying to defame the gods and present them as, you know... Thor is a transgender because he put on a dress to get back his hammer from some giants or something. So yeah, not a good person. I'm not surprised. Anyone who calls himself a male feminist is a big red flag. So for all women out there, if you ever see a woman like that, red flag.
So one thing I wanted to ask you about, Marcus, and we've got a super chat about this that we'll flow on from into in a second. What do you make of this, you see, I think there's an issue here, and I wanted to discuss this with you because you're a man, and you're a man's man, and you also a man who has enjoyed the company of women and know what women want. But there's this rage at the moment for these OnlyFans models to sleep with hundreds. One's claiming she slept with 1,001 men in a single day now, and they're basically racking up these insane body counts in a 24-hour period. And the media cover this incessantly. So you've got all the tabloids, you've got your sort of, your news shows, etc. They're all covering it. It's all over social media. It's the talk of social media. There's two of them. There's one called Lily Phillips and another one called Bonnie Blue. And Bonnie Blue claims to have slept. I think it's I'm going to get the actual headline right. A gynecologist breaks down Bonnie Blue's claim that she had sex with 1,057 men in 12 hours and reveals the reality of physical strain and intimate trauma. Now, firstly, the idea of a woman sleeping with 1,000 men in 12 hours is utterly stomach churning. But I find it very interesting that these women are undertaking these feats. The media talk about it. It's all over social media. And at the same time, we've got this huge number of migrants arriving from sort of Middle East, Africa, etc., where India, the Indian subcontinent, where attitudes towards sex can be very, very different. And when these men arrive here, they're seeing these stories that are all over the headlines all the time. OnlyFans, model does 100 men in, an afternoon. This one's done 1,000 men in an afternoon. There's a super chat here about a woman that walks around in her underwear on trains and just reveals herself, opens up a coat and shows that she's in her underwear. I think this is very dangerous, that the mixing of this kind of slut behavior and the tabloids amplifying it, and then the migrants seeing it. I'm not giving migrants a pass for the hideous things they do. There's no excuse for raping women. But when you have these men arriving here, the first thing they're confronted with are these stories of Western women sleeping with hundreds of men in a single day. I think this is the media, again, putting Western women at risk and seeding things in migrants' minds that white women are fair game.
Yeah, even without the migrants, I think it's an ongoing revolt against everything that is normal, healthy, beautiful, and natural. I mean, this level of promiscuity should be criminalized. It's Yeah, I don't even find words for it. But, you know, any healthy, normal, well-adjusted man will find promiscuity, as you said, stomach churning. So it doesn't even need to be these numbers, any type of promiscuity. And it's anti-female sentiment to be accepting of promiscuity because it's damaging towards women. And that's something as well that maybe, you know, if you are, you know, you go to university when you're 20 and you hear these feminists, they talk about free love and everything like that. And, you know, claiming control over bodies, and you think, aha, so accepting promiscuity, it's something good for women, but it's actually very damaging for women. I suppose everyone knows this now that, you know, you emotionally attached to your partner. And then when you get, you know, ripped away from him all the time, you sort of deaden yourself inside. So for anyone who's actually loving of women, protecting of women, then we need to combat this, promiscuous attitudes as well. So, you know, the immigrant thing and the messaging, you know, the messages sent to them, one thing also absolutely horrible, but even without them, this type of, it's just plain wrong to behave in this way. And absolutely, it should not be legal to engage in that type of behavior, and it definitely not to broadcast it. And OnlyFans should be shut down as well, for that matter.
Oh, I definitely agree with you. OnlyFans need shuttering immediately. But my number one concern is that these women not only are terrible role models and drag other women into this sort of moral sewer, but it does paint the picture, which the media have attempted to paint for years, that Western women are basically all up for it, all gagging for it, they all want it. And the men coming here look at that. They come from countries where modesty is the norm. So, you know, if you come from a place like Syria, you're not, you know, Syria or anywhere in the Middle East, you probably haven't, and especially if you come from Pakistan or Bangladesh or India, you haven't seen women parading around like that. And you see a normal woman in a summer dress and you're told that women who look like that, you know, are sleeping with 100 men and think it's all fun and games. I think it's and you mix that with as well, you know, some of these men are not high IQ. They're not people who function well in high trust, high IQ societies. They've never lived in that kind of society. I think this is the media setting white girls up for absolute disaster. And I think OnlyFans needs to be shut down. And these women who are actually doing this, there needs to be laws that govern this kind of behavior and prevent the exposure of this. I'll actually read the super chat. It's a $12 one from Stars Nikki Foroff. Thank you so much. She said, "Hi guys, Mark, this trend of doing random sexy stuff on camera for attention becomes more trendy among mostly white Western British women. In my recent emails, I'll send you another example of white British girl. Her name is Cassie Bale, who is exposing her body and beautiful underwear on camera in front of random people on the streets or public transportation. My question is for both of you, Mark. You obviously use public transportation from time to time when you're traveling. Guys, imagine this. You get on the train with your daughters and you see some random, very attractive female doing content, exposing herself on camera for her OnlyFans, and you end up being recorded without your consent. How would you respond to this?" I'll let you go first. If you're on a train or a public transport and you saw one of these OnlyFans models flashing her underwear and you're there with your children, how would you respond to that?
Yeah, I would just go up to her, politely ask her to, you know, put the dress back, cover herself and stop filming. And if she had filmed anything of us, then to kindly delete it from her phone or camera.
You see, I think this, again, it's an issue of public decency. I've just looked up this woman. I'm not going to show you her on camera. I mean, she is a very, very attractive woman. She looks obviously very good in her underwear. And, you know, she's not just taking the pictures of herself, though, in her home. What she's doing is she's dressing in, you know, very, very provocative outfits. She's on what looks like a tram, on what is clearly a train. I think she's on the London Underground. She's usually wearing a long coat. She then removes, said coat or unzips it and, you know, essentially bares herself for everyone to see on public transport. And imagine, you know, you're out having a nice day with your family and this is what you're faced with. You know, I mean, a few years ago, this would have been unthinkable, but now it's the norm. It's seen as basically just edgy and fun content, when in fact it's completely socially corrosive. That's the last thing I would want my little girl to see if we were having a day out. And I think I would do the same if she was filming and doing this kind of thing. I'd say, look, can you please stop doing this? It's indecent. You know, it's indecent. And, you know, you need to stop. There are normal people trying to enjoy a normal day out. We don't want to see you naked. You know, there are so, and this is the other thing. I'm going to ask you this. It's corrosive enough that this stuff takes place and is so widely available online. But the way this now filters into normal life and you have people doing it in public places, more or less just day and night for content, where does this end?
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't know. I think it's like with all things, you know, the pendulum swings, and we can only hope that many of these things, and perhaps I'm too optimistic here, but I would say that stuff like, you know, Drag Queen Story Hour, that sort of peaked already, from what I can sense at least. You know, they had their ultimate moment of, you know, being explicitly edgy, but now it's not so edgy anymore, so therefore it's not so fun anymore either. So, I mean, they're doing it to provoke, basically. That's the kick, they get to provoke, and then they've gotten it, and, you know, not so fun anymore. But maybe I'm too optimistic. I don't know.
Well, I hope it comes to an end. I mean, I made a video last year about what was going on at gay pride events, where you've got grown men rolling around in paddling pools being urinated on as children walk past. You know, you know, and look, putting things into perspective, and I don't want to start ranking things, but if I was out in a public place and a beautiful woman was walking down the street in lacy underwear, yes, I don't want that in a public place. But still, that is much, much better than grown men in bondage gear urinating on each other. And, you know, the slide into the pit of sort of filth and degeneracy has gone so far. You kind of like when this guy sent the super chat, and this is a really nice guy, but and he writes to me, he's a great guy. But when he sent me the super chat and I looked up this woman, I was just like, yeah, she's hot and she's in underwear on a train. I've seen worse, and I shouldn't be thinking like that. But my initial reaction is, even I've become so sort of, you know, habituated to seeing these absolute horrors of the modern world that you see a pretty girl on a train in her pants and you're like, well, it could be worse.
Yeah.
It's like, I don't know, do you have the gay pride stuff? Is that as corrosive in Sweden, or is that worse in Sweden than it is here in the UK?
So it's been like the state religion for maybe 10-15 years, something like that. And by state religion, it's like, you know, you have a religious procession, the gay pride, you have the month, you have the flags signaling, you know, if you're a restaurant, you signal your virtue that you're part of the religion. So it's like, you know, putting up a cross was 100 years ago. But I would say that it's losing its excitement a bit, especially since some darker stuff has come out to the public as well, because many, many people, myself included, you know, up until I was like 25 or so, I just thought, yeah, I mean, it's all about love, you know, it's it's all about that. But then when you look deeper into it, it's of course very, very dark stuff, very dark stuff indeed. And this has come more to the attention of the mainstream now. So I would still say that it's maybe the holiest thing in the Swedish mainstream society. So, you know, you can bash multiculturalism and stuff, but what's on top of that is like homosexuality, basically. So it's still a very sensitive topic, but I would say, at least perhaps I'm a bit too optimistic, but I think some people have gotten a bit enough of it as well. So I think they overplayed their hand with this, you know, imported American stuff with the transgenders and stuff like that.
Agreed. Thin Red Line gave $14. Thank you so much. A good topic. We have to support Marcus. Yeah, and look, this goes without saying, but Marcus is a shining light in this movement. He's someone who has never let anyone down. He's always been there. Never could he be described as humble. And never, ever will I play Age of Empires 3 with him again. I have to and smile as I was publicly humiliated. But yes, he is a great guy, and we should all support him. And I'll say this, if they do come for you, mate, I, you know, I will wholeheartedly support you in any way that I can and your family. Purple Sage gave $25. Thank you for the generous super chat. And he said, two-tier anti-white justice is prevalent throughout the Western world, but it is particularly sickening what has been happening in the UK and Europe. I hope the great wake-up happens sooner rather than later and we regain control of our institutions and our countries. Thank you both. Yeah, I mean, I obviously hope we win. You know, I'm not being negative, but my big concern is that everyone's going to wake up just as we tick over into being a minority. And I think there was a guy in the BNP who described it perfectly. He said, waking up for British towns and cities is like, it's almost like they're on a conveyor belt in a sawmill. So like, you know, every city's a lump of wood that's on the sawmill and the conveyor belt's taking these blocks of wood towards the saw. And the further away they are from the spinning blade, the less they believe they're ever going to be chopped up. There's no such thing as the saw. We're fine. Look, I can't see any saw. And then the closer they get, the more they're like, maybe the people talking about us being chopped to pieces have got a good point, until eventually you're almost on the saw blade and then the block of wood's like, look, the saw blade's real. We've got to do something. Stop the conveyor belt. But, you know, everyone who's further away are saying, who's that alarmist over there? Tell him to shut up. And you saw this in the UK. So the BNP did very, very well in the outer rim of Bradford because the centre of Bradford had been completely colonised. You know, the BNP did very well in parts of Essex because the people in Essex were white flight people who had fled London, which had been lost. And that's really my thing. I don't know what you think about that. Do you see that in Sweden, that the areas that do better are areas that are on the border to these places that have been completely colonised?
You know, the Sweden Democrats, they've exploded in popularity over the last 10 years. I've said this before, I'll say it again. You know, back in 2010, if you said, as I did, by the way, you know, I supported the Sweden Democrats, people were like, oh, damn, what did you say? You can't say that. But now you can say, you know, I'm for large-scale re-migration, and, you know, you will have your ordinary man and woman will say, like, you know, could probably be a good idea. So it's gone extremely fast. But to respond to the actual question, we had in the early popularity of the Sweden Democrats came from areas where it was worse. So Skåne, so Scania, where Malmö is. So Malmö is one of the worst affected places in Sweden. So therefore, the surrounding areas there, they were, you know, heavy Sweden Democrat places.
Thank you. Der Cheruska said, good episode and good takes. Keep on fighting for $5. Thank you so much. It Was Made Up gave $15. Thank you so much. And said, looking forward to hearing the interview. You always represent the movement very well. Same goes for Marcus. I've obviously previewed the interview I did at the BBC with a number of people, including my legal representative. And everyone who's seen it so far has given me positive feedback. I promise you, I went in there and did my best. I gave everything I had to represent you guys. And I can tell you, if this sets the stage for that interview, I drank an entire double can of Red Bull before I went in. It wasn't just a single can. It wasn't just one of these little ones. It was like two. All right, two cans. So it wasn't quite a three. I don't think we've ever had a three can event, but a two can event is the maximum I've ever done before. What do you think to that, Marcus? If I do a two can event, are you looking forward to hearing me after two cans?
Yeah, definitely. Let's go.
and when I got to the BBC building, they had four security guards there who completely like went over me as if like I was like Carlos the Jackal. I'll tell that full story on another day, but they were ready and waiting for me. But luckily, the guy I took, who, I don't know if anyone's seen the picture, the guy I took for my security was bigger than like all of them by quite a way. And there's a picture of me stood with him, and he makes me look about 4 foot tall. I'm obviously not 4 foot tall. He's just absolutely gigantic. Marcus, I'll ask you this as well. You know, when you see these girls like Bonnie Blue who sleep with 1,000 men and stuff like that, like, from my perspective, do you think a man like me or a man like you could fix a woman like that? Do you think that's what they need, or do you think they're so fundamentally broken nothing can be done for them?
Yeah, no, that's a lost cause, definitely. I mean, I don't think there's so much to salvage there at all, and I don't think any man should attempt to do it either.
No, okay, so I'll rephrase the question. If a woman like that had met a strong man like yourself before she'd gone down that path, or do you think there are broken women who will always do that and can only be restrained by a moral society?
Yeah, so I think usually when, like all manner of sexual deviances, it can come as a result of trauma in the childhood or early teens. Perhaps she's been abused as a, you know, adolescent or something like that. And then, you know, a sort of self-hate comes to you. I know the Milo Yiannopoulos, he talked about this quite openly as well when it came to homosexuality, that, you know, and this was an eye-opener for me too, because I didn't really think about it, because in school we thought, like, just, you know, homosexuality is just something you're born with and this and that. But then, you know, many become sort of that way. I'm not claiming to be an expert in it. I'm just saying that many sexual deviances later on, they can be traced to trauma in the early years. So I think that is a main culprit, you know, really bad things happening at an early age. And then, you know, it's like an alcoholic. You might have a gene for it, and then you get exposed to alcohol, and then it's just a downhill from there. It gets worse. So I'd say for many of these women, they wouldn't have been that way if they hadn't been exposed to, you know, some sort of trauma, and then their lifestyle, it only makes it worse going down the spiral. But I'd say for a normal woman, say a woman who just, you know, falls for peer pressure, and she is otherwise, you know, she hasn't been subject to a trauma, in that case, if she finds a good man early on, then she might be saved from a, you know, Sex in the City lifestyle fate, you know, childless at whatever age it might be. So I'd say it depends, but we should definitely try to combat all of this anti-family values, anti-female values, and
You see, I look at someone like you, and I love spending time with my daughter. It's absolutely fantastic. Like, we have snow here, which is nothing for you because you get snow all the time, but we don't really get snow very often here. And we've got a sort of little green space near our house. And it's a place where water can pool if we get any flooding. And as the snow sort of melted a little bit, it all pooled and then it froze and formed sort of a 2 to 3 inch thick sort of sheet of pure clear ice. And we spent days going down there and sledging across it and ice skating and stuff like that. And I really enjoyed it. And I loved spending that time with her. And it was like one of those moments which, as long as I don't get sort of dementia or lose my marbles, I'll never forget doing that with her and how happy she was. And I'm sure you've got memories like that with your own child. And I sometimes wonder with these sort of Bonnie Blue characters or Lily Phillips characters, did they ever have moments like that with the parenting, with parents? Or was it just hands-off parenting where they just shoved in front of the TV and, you know, grew up in a world without that connection?
Yeah, I'd say so. And this is also something I think with my own two girls, like I look at older women and I think to myself often, okay, this is probably because the father wasn't there. He was not a good role model. He wasn't loving enough. So the response is then, if you want to optimize the life outcome for your children, is to just, you know, give love, give attention as much as possible. So that's something I always keep in mind, that when I look at, you know, a woman of ill repute or however you say it, then I think to myself, okay, that is what happens if you don't take your sacred duty as a father seriously. So also that's a good point. You know, an absent father or a bad father.
Because we've got a couple more chats about this. Glenn 19 gave a dollar. Thank you so much. He said, Mark, the group of men looking to be one of the 1,000 men to have sex with Bonnie Blue look like they belong in a Rotherham grooming gang. I'm sure this is to encourage more rapes and grooming gangs. I mean, that's something we've said. I mean, imagine being one of 1,000. I mean, that's another thing, Marcus, as a man, like, let's talk about this as men, you know, nothing could be more enraging from my point of view than to think there's lots of things that are enraging. Like, you know, like if somebody damaged my game collection, that would be enraging. You know, if somebody scratched my car, that would be enraging. But if somebody was to say, like, imagine somebody sleeping with your wife, that's not a turn on. That's something that sickens you to the core. Like, as a man, can you think of anything more horrible than standing in a queue with a bunch of sort of, you know, weird looking migrant men and saying, oh, I'm number 342. I've just got to wait for Abdul to finish first. I mean, it's shocking, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, all of those men should be imprisoned as well. I mean, it's just so, it's man-made horrors beyond belief. It's completely insane. It's, definitely something that needs to go. And I think it will also. I mean, everyone looks at this and says, this is not a good idea. It for anyone.
But the interesting thing is, and this is the sort of counterfoil to this, we've got all these migrants coming in, but if these Islamic groups, and it is the Muslims in this country that breed at the most rapid rate, you know, there's just a fact, they have large families and they colonize areas very quickly. But if they actually did take power, the irony of this is that would be the end to OnlyFans and Bonnie Blue and Lily Phillips and women on trains, you know, showing their underwear and their boobs and stuff. It'd be over. And I do find this society quite strange, because the end result of liberalism may well be, if it doesn't go our way, may well be sort of this sort of crashing end to their liberal society, thanks to the migrants. I mean, I heard, and this is following up for a question with you, and I hope you know about this, and if you don't, it's no problem, really. But I heard that in Sweden there was a historic gay pride march that took a specific route until that route became ethnically enriched, and they had to reroute it so it didn't go past Muslim areas or past mosques, etc.
I mean, that was more of a publicity stunt by, you know, these counter-jihadist types. So they just wanted to show the hypocrisy of the mainstream Swedish thing. So it was like, you know, this conservative, you know, the type Tommy Robinson equivalent in Sweden, that type of political level it was. So, yeah.
Thank you so much. Poit gave $25. Thank you much. And said donation. Thank you very much. Rachel Goldstein asked a question that I don't think I'm allowed to ask on here without making sort of racial stereotypes. So I apologize, but it was for a dollar. So thank you for that. Jagdeep Jaina gave $5. Thank you so much. She said, Bonnie Blue went on ITV this morning, and I believe it was in that interview, she said she had no sexual abuse or trauma as a child, and her parents are accepting of her choices. I think there are some women who are just depraved. But this is another thing, Marcus. I mean, I love my daughter more than anything in the world. But if, you know, I can't imagine accepting a choice like that, or even wanting to know a child of mine if they engaged in that kind of activity. What kind of father could carry on having a relationship with his daughter knowing that she was engaging in that activity?
Mm. Yeah, I mean, that's a failure on the father. And I don't think that father is loving at all, because if he were actually loving, then he wouldn't tolerate it at all. I mean, self-harming activities, it's nothing good to accept it at all. So I think it's something rotten there deep in the psyche.
Someone said she actually went into Five Guys and tried to get the black man who was behind the counter to have sex with her. And she rejected her. He rejected her and just said, no, this is hideous. You know, and, you know, the person sending the chat says fair play to him for saying no. But, you know, I can't imagine, you know, a mother and a father, there must be something significantly wrong with a mother and a father that accept that from their daughter. You know, like, I think I'm a pretty reasonable guy. And I've always said that women who make mistakes should really be, embraced if they turn their back on the mistake. So like we talked about this woman, this Mai Vingren, right? And let's say tomorrow she rang you up and said, look, Marcus, I woke up this morning and what I've done to you is terrible. I want to reevaluate my life. I want to apologize to you and your wife. And you are right. I watched the show last night with Mark and both of you are right. I'm completely wrong. I would advocate for us, you know, showing sort of forgiveness to people who, you know, have said they've done the wrong thing and turned their back on things like that. But as a parent, as a dad, I don't think I could forgive my daughter doing what Bonnie Blue's doing.
Mm. Yeah, no, definitely not. And again, it's like I severely doubt that the father is actually, you know, if he cares at all, because again, if he would care, he would stop it immediately. So, yeah.
Shlomophobe gave $5. Thank you so much. So this all started with the need for coins to have milled edges. Thank you so much. We've got a chat over on Rumble as well. Sir Thomas Drake gave $5. Thank you so much. Said, hi, Mark. I found your stuff by iHypocrite. Great work. And find Legio Glorio through Thomas Roswell. Love my knit wool sweater. Thanks, guys. Look, I got to say this. The Golden One will have noticed that. Obviously, in winter, I don't wear his stuff to demos because I've got a big coat on. But if I ever go to a demo in summer, or a camp or something like that, I'm always wearing his T-shirts. And I've got to say, and I mean this because I'm not somebody who's a big clothes expert. I know good clothes, but generally I don't spend a lot on clothes. I usually wear fitted T-shirts and I usually buy stuff from Primark. I only spend significant amounts on suits, shoes and shirts. I don't spend significant amounts on T-shirts. But I'll say this, of all the T-shirts I own, the highest quality are the ones that Marcus sells. They are really durable. They are rugged. They look really nice. The fabric feels fantastic. You can actually wear them hiking, camping, for outdoor wear. They're also smart enough to wear to barbecues and things like that. And they fit really well. They don't sag out in the middle. They pull you in around the chest. They are tapered. So it gives your physique, if you've been to the gym, the look that you want. And every time I've worn them to demonstrations, people have been very, very complimentary about the T-shirts. And they're very reasonably priced as well. And another thing that my wife has pointed out, because she understands this, being a woman, when you wash them, the colours remain. They're not like garments that you order off Temu or AliExpress and you wash them once and they shrink and you lose all the colour. I've worn my maroon Legio Gloria T-shirt many times, washed it many times. It retains its colour, its shape, and it doesn't look tired when you wash it. So Marcus has really done well on sourcing sort of the top quality stuff for people to wear. So if you're in the market for a good quality T-shirt, this guy knows what he's doing.
Oh, thank you very much. Makes me very happy to hear.
We've got one from Mitch, and he gave $2. Thank you so much. He said, question to you, Mark. Do you have to get off? Are you all right for 10 more minutes? Or?
Yeah, sure, we can go 10 more minutes.
Yeah. Because we're near the end of the show now anyway.
This is basically in the middle of the night for me, by the way. I'm a very Apollonian man, not a Dionysian man.
What time is it there?
Nah, it's almost 10, but...
I'm always in bed for 10, but we'll...
Yeah. If I'm not at my most eloquent and sharp, you all know why. It's because I am a purely Apollonian archetype. I can only perform in the morning, and at night I become a zombie without any eloquence at all. So now you know.
Well, Brandon Collins gave $10. Thank you so much. You're both great voices and examples for our people. Onward to victory. Thank you very much. And Sally gave $5. Thank you so much. So just a small contribution towards all the good work that you do. Thank you, Mark and Marcus. Well, thank you very much. And Mitch gave $2. Thank you so much. So question to you, Mark. You've said a few times the aim is to get UK 95% white British. But do you not think the aim should be what it was pre-Windrush, which is 99%? Many seem to like hair splitting, but wonder why you wouldn't mind a 5% leeway. I think you've got to be realistic about what you're aiming for. And, you know, I'm not a defeatist, but I have given you, look, here's the issue. In fact, I'm just going to cut to the chase. The schools are 61.3% white British. That is going to be a reflection of the key breeding demographic in 15 years, but it'll be worse because more migrants will have come here by then. Now, multicultural, multiracial society has had a large degree of integration. There are people with mixed race children. There are people who have married white people from Eastern Europe or married Swedish girls. You know, I do know white nationalists or ethno-nationalists in this country, you know, with French wives. I know ethno-nationalists in this country with Polish wives and girlfriends. I think it would be very, very difficult to aim and impractical to aim for a 99% white British society now. I think things have gone too far for that. I think 95% is reasonable. I think it's acceptable. I think it would be accepted by normal people. And I'll say this. The reason why people are saying now that I'm being defeatist is because I'm being a realist. I don't think that any person who's likely to actually get elected would ever advocate for any of the children in British schools to be repatriated, to be deported. That's the problem. So Farage at best, and he's the only real hope for anyone getting into a position of power. But Farage at best will be willing to say we need to deport illegal migrants or people who have come here legally and committed criminal acts. He is not going to say we're going to be going around the local primary schools with big vans, catching the kids in nets and putting them on boats out of here. That isn't going to happen. You know, there is a reality to all this. So basically what I'm saying is electorally, and that is the only way that you're going to get power electorally, the best you're going to get is Farage, and he isn't going to give you what you want. Equally, the best you're going to get in Germany is the AfD, and they're not going to be deporting the school kids. Neither's Marine Le Pen. Neither are the Swedish Democrats. There is a reality to this, and what you have to aim for has to be achievable. We are now so far down the road with this social engineering experiment that the only way you would see a white Britain like that is if there was some cataclysmic event and the migrants all chose to leave because we were living in a Mad Max irradiated hellhole. I mean, I don't know what it's like for you over in Sweden, but more and more you see people buying into this. And one of the big problems is, even if we are, so the government said, but the last census in 2021, we were 74.4% white British. Well, I think that was rubbish. And I think by now, with all the incredible amounts of migration we've seen since then, I think we're about 70%. We'll be around 70% white British. But of those 70%, a huge amount would never vote for an ethno-nationalist party because they are in some way emotionally attached to migrants who have come here. I mean, what do you think to that? Because, I mean, obviously you must have people engaged in mixed race relationships in Sweden. You have people who are, you know, who've got kids, grandkids from those backgrounds.
Yeah, so I would say that, and I'm going to use a gym example now. So whenever you start a gym, you don't look at, I want to look like this particular, if I may flatter myself, may I flatter myself for a moment? Is that
it? You're going to, so just do it.
I will. So if someone says, oh, I want to look like the golden one, this is not something you should think. You should think to yourself, okay, what is the next session tomorrow? What will I do tomorrow to get closer to my goal? And then you don't need to think so much about the goal. And then, of course, metaphorically speaking, in terms of remigration, it's like, what can we do now? Yes, we can make the moral case for remigration. And I want to give a shout out to Martin Sellner of Austria. He has made in his remigration a proposal. I think it will come out in English this year. I read it in German last year, and he makes, you know, a really detailed case for remigration, including a a moral case, a practical case, and everything like that. So instead of arguing about how many percent of non-whites can be in Britain, it's, you know, focus on implementing first a moral framework for people to believe in, understanding that it's okay to put British people first. It's okay. That is the first step. And then not overly worry overly much about, you know, the exact percentage of something later on. And also something I have, you know, I've had the same political opinions for all of my life. I've only shifted the nuance. And what I've come to realize now is that it's better to look at trends. So if we start saying we're going to deport criminals and people on welfare, and then we're not going to accept anyone unless they are, you know, have any romantic reasons or any professional reasons or whatever it might be, then we've solved a lot of the problem. And then, yes, of course, there will still be non-whites in Sweden. Some of them, they will be admixed into the gene pool. We have especially many women from Thailand here. They will be admixed in the gene pool. It's just how it is. But the trend will still be, if we get to power and we say that we're going to create a society or we'll reshape the society to make sure that normal Swedish families will be able to have more children. So the taxpayers' money, it doesn't go to feeding people on welfare who do nothing else but to have children. I mean, that's a trend. And then it will not be like this. Now we deport everyone who isn't Swedish or European or whatever, but it will be a trend that favors the birth rates of normal European families or Swedish families. So that is a better view to look at it in my humble opinion, that you look at the next step and the long-term trend. That's what you look at. So you can look at, you know, propaganda for race mixing, for example. You see black man, white woman all the time. Yes, there's a reason for that. It's a trend that needs to be broken or, you know, shifted or whatever. Some other cases. So if you have like, I'm just taking one example. You have a Swedish man and a Chinese woman. I don't think there are so many Swedish men with Chinese women, and I don't think those like five guys, they aren't an issue because that's not a trend that is going up. But having mass migration from now, of course, I will say, of course, you should, for anyone who's listening to this, go for a woman who looks like you so that you will have children who look like you. That's definitely the goal always. But I'm saying that on a personal note, and especially if we're looking at, you know, eagle eye perspective, bird's eye perspective on a country, in the long run, it doesn't matter so much if you have a little admixture from somewhere else. That is absolutely not to condone any, you know, mass migration or anything like that. But it's about being realistic and looking at the trend. The trend now is mass immigration from Africa and the Middle East. That is a trend that needs to go in the different direction. So the main thing to obsess about is not what will be done with someone who's a quarter Asian in Sweden in 30 years. It's like the big trend we need to look at. And of course, the next step always. What is the next step?
Well, thank you very much. That's a very good answer. And I agree. I think if you set a reasonable goal, you're more likely to reach it. So, you know, if you say to somebody, right, we're going to do a 10K together, and, you know, the first goal is let's get it under an hour, people will be like, well, I think we could do that. I think, but if you say like, well, we're going to do a 10K and the goal is 40 minutes, they're going to be like, oh my God, forget it, mate, forget it. So I do think you've got to move in that way. And I do think, the one thing I will say though, and this upsets people, but I actually looked at the data for mixed race marriages, and the highest percentage of mixed race marriages in the UK is apparently white men and Oriental females. And that's, you know, obviously it's broken down into many little groups. There's white men and Oriental females, white men and black females, white men and what we call Asian, which is from the Indian subcontinent. And then there's white female and black males, etc. But, you know, if you look at the large, it's not a majority, but the largest group of interracial relationships is actually white men and Oriental females, which, you know, flies in the face of a lot of what nationalists say, that all the race mixing is driven by women, which that's not necessarily true. Drum and Bass World gave $5. Thank you so much. Said, I have no proof, but I suspect pushes for extreme atomizing positions is one of the regime's strategies. One example being really toxic on ethnocentrism, where they think that means you have to be horrible to other races. And I sometimes think that as well. Like, you know, when you have people calling for simply, you know, literally the most extreme position possible, that does alienate normal people. And I think you can package ethno-nationalism in a way that is attractive. But to do so, you have to be pragmatic, basically, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, and also something to think about. It's like, it's easy to be radical online when you don't really engage all too much in the world. But if you want to appeal to, you know, the 50-year-old professional in wherever he might be, a normal-sized European city, I mean, he's going to have, you know, some sort of colleague from the Middle East, maybe, or at least some sort of business associate. He can't subscribe to the more radical stuff, but he can definitely subscribe to a platform that says, you know, no more immigrants from this part of the world, and those who haven't behaved well or those who haven't any specific competence, they need to go back. This is something you can subscribe to. But when you start doing this really, yeah, as you say, like really crazy ideas, it's not a good argument, and it's not going to get good people on board with us.
Shores in Flames gave $5, thank you so much. And he said, what are both of your thoughts on survivalism, self-sufficiency and Varg Vikernes? I believe we need to live simpler lives and not contribute to this rotten system. What's your thoughts on Varg and survivalism and going away and living out in the wild?
Nah, so on a personal note, I think he did at least say that I took steroids, so I don't like him because of that. But then we had a conversation on Twitter like maybe last year sometime, and he said, okay, I trust you when you say that you're not on steroids.
I know, anyway, Marcus doesn't take steroids. His body definition is completely different to that of people who take steroids.
Thanks. Yeah, it is. But when it comes to living a simpler life, no, I don't want to live a simpler life. I want to get as much power as possible in society to change society according to my vision. So that's what I want.
I quite like the idea of going away and sort of living in the woods and living a simple life. I do like that. And sometimes I watch these survivalist videos. I really do enjoy them. And you see a guy who's built like a house that's, you know, raised off the ground, and it's got moss on the roof, and he's growing his own vegetables. And I sit down and think, God, that would be nice. And then I realize that my Ethernet connection would be non-existent. I couldn't play PUBG online. And I wouldn't have any form of central heating or be able to take 2 to 3 showers a day. And my missus wouldn't be able to bake those really charming white chocolate and raspberry flapjacks. So all in all,
yes, same here. And I think many guys, they romanticize it as well. But then you have guys who have actually lived that lifestyle and say, you know, maybe it's not for everyone. And certainly for me, no, I don't want to grow my own food. I don't want to do it. I want to spend the time I don't spend with my family or doing fun things. I want to spend, you know, pushing our metapolitical message. I don't want to take that time to grow food, but maybe we'll grow something, we'll see. But that's more for fun and, you know, for as a meditation project, you know, to grow some nice vegetables or herbs.
We grow nice vegetables just as a family activity.
That's nice. But to go off grid like that, it's not the aim. The aim now is again to push the metapolitical, to push the moral framework as often and as competent as possible.
Finn Red Line gave $5. Thank you so much. Said, hi, Mark. I think it would be good to have Martin Selner on here. I don't think Martin Selner would have anything to do with me because I speak about the JQ and I work with people like David Duke and Mike Enoch and Warren Baylog and people like that. And I think he has kind of like this hard line
I think you need to have a hard line in Germany, because they are, you know, in Austria and Germany, they are already on him a lot. So yeah, I wouldn't blame him for something like that.
But also, I don't really understand Martin Selner's current sort of thing, because on one hand, he wants remigration. He's like, we need a remigration conference. We need to do remigration. Remigration has to be what we do. But then, like tonight, we've talked about the practicalities. The practicalities are very different. And it's all well and good all sitting in a room saying we want remigration. But really, there's only the driving force in Europe has always been Germany, France, and the UK and Britain. Germany, France, and Britain have been that sort of central core of European superpowers. And all three of those have huge parties that could theoretically form a government at some point. The AfD, the Front National, now, you know, the National Rally, and Reform. And he is somebody that would be blocked from having anything to do with those parties, because his organization was banned in France. So the Front National would have nothing to do. Marine Le Pen wouldn't entertain him. I don't think the AfD would entertain him. And Farage definitely wouldn't. So unless you've got power over those three parties, I can't see how you can credibly say that you can drive remigration. Now, if he came on this show, I would love to ask him how you're going to drive remigration without having a controlling, you know, share over those parties. But I just don't see it myself.
I'm going to white pill. I'm going to bring some white pill here. But I mean, in Austria, for example, they've started to talk about it, and their party, they did really well in the last election. And the AfD, you know, same thing as in the Sweden Democrats, you have different factions within the AfD, so Alternative for Germany. You have a faction which is really based, to use that term, and they are, you know, talking maybe a bit hesitant at first, but they still could implement remigration. And here's something to keep in mind as well, that Sweden, for example, or Germany, we send out people every day. We deport people every single day. It's just a matter of doing it at a larger scale. We say to people that, no, you can't get into Sweden and you have to go back. So, I mean, we are already sending out people. It's just a matter of doing it in a larger scale. So saying that all criminals, they need to go. So, I mean, and something to keep in mind as well is that these conservatives, they are looking at us. And they say, aha, this is a good position that will go home, probably, hopefully. So I've seen this, you know, live in Sweden, especially when it comes to the moderates, so the normie conservative party. They've done a quite rapid flip here. Same thing with SD, the Sweden Democrats, when it comes to remigration. So, I mean, it can go fast as well. And if you have these guys in power already, who knows?
I think it's going to take a lot to do that. Like I said, I'm more of the mindset that we need to be preparing for a future where we will be a minority, and we need to think how we can advocate for our people in that prospect. That's really where I am. But I'd happily discuss them. If the one guy I'd want on PWR more than ever at the moment is actually Thomas Rousseau from Patriot Front. I've never had him on here, but Patriot Front did all that amazing work in America when there was the hurricanes. And I think that kind of community work that they've done, for me, was a real white pill to see guys out there helping people, you know, helping clear trees that have blown down, providing food and water for people. I see that, and I genuinely see something that I found really inspiring. Anyway, got one last super chat. Thank you so much. It's from Rachel Goldstein. It says, patriotic alternative, stance on Englishmen marrying Russian women online. If you want to marry a Russian woman online and bring her here, that's up to you. I mean, you know, I can understand why a lonely white guy would be attracted to a potentially more submissive and homely Eastern European or Russian woman and bring them to Britain.
I don't think a Russian woman is particularly submissive, though, to be honest.
They are very beautiful, though. They are very beautiful. And I can understand that. Anyway, look, I've kept you for far too long, my friend. So give yourself an outro, and my apologies for well, you chose to be here to the end, but thank you so much for doing that. And I know we said we were going to go for about an hour and a half, but you said, you know, I've had to have done the best solo. So thank you for being here.
Yeah, my pleasure. Always nice to talk to you. And again, if I wasn't as sharp in my communication, I have not taken a triple Red Bull. My last coffee of the day was taken at like 11. So yeah, long time. The caffeine has left me. But yeah, good stuff as always anyway.
Well, thank you so much. Please do support Marcus. Anyway, I'm going to close the stream down now. Thank you to Marcus. Thank you to everybody who super chatted so generously. Thank you so much to everyone who was in the chat, who supported, who shared, etc., etc., etc. And I just want to say, keep your eye out on Friday for my conversation, my hour and 9 minute debate with a BBC journalist. I will be publishing that so you can hear the truth of what they are trying to do. That will be out at 1 p.m. on Friday. Thank you so much, everybody. Look after yourselves. I'll be back same time next week for another episode of Patriotic Weekly Review. And obviously, Thomas Russo, if you're watching this or you hear this, you'd be more than welcome to come on and join me. I'd very much like to talk to you about the excellent work Patriot Front is doing. Until next week, stay strong, keep fighting, and I'll see you all again soon. Thank you, everybody, and good night.